Hello, 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 and a very warm welcome to the 2024 Big Spud podcast. I'm Andre from The Mental Elf, and over the next few episodes, I'm going to be speaking with many of the people who will be giving keynote talks at the Big Spud conference in Belfast in June 2024. In case you don't know, Big Spud is the conference for people living with and working with the difficulties often described as personality disorder. It's an organisation that we here at The Mental Elf have been working closely with for a number of years, and it's always a fantastic event that brings people together, people with lived experience, practitioners, researchers and others. Now, taking someone to hospital against their will and forcing treatment upon them is one of the most controversial areas of mental health care. We know that compulsory treatment is more common in certain groups, and laws in many countries are desperately outdated and in need of reform. Today, we welcome three experts in mental capacity and compulsory intervention to the podcast to talk about how this topic relates to people with a diagnosis of personality disorder. Those experts are Professor Gavin Davidson from Queen's University Belfast and Dr. Ian McDougall and Steph Kerr from Belfast Health and Social Care Trust. Welcome, Gavin and Ian and Steph, to the podcast. Really, really lovely to have you here. Very excited about hearing about your work, and this is a really good topic for Big Spud. I wanted to start off just by asking you, are you all born and bred in Belfast? What's your background?
I grew up in West Belfast, which would be maybe one of the bigger areas of social deprivation in Belfast. Lots of mental ill health, socioeconomic difficulties, etc. I don't live there now. I live just outside Belfast now, Newton Abbey, but born, raised, schooled, educated, etc., all in Belfast. And then, of course, work for Belfast Trust.
I'm kind of very similar to Steph in many ways. I'm probably on the cusp of West and South Belfast growing up. Went to school in Belfast, went to university, dipped into some trips abroad at different times to get out of here for a little while, but generally stayed in Belfast and, like Steph, worked for the Belfast Trust at this stage in the personality disorders here.
So I grew up just to the north of Belfast where Steph lives now, and I'm sure it's very different now, Steph, but I was keen to escape from Newton Abbey and so sort of went away to study. But when I come back, it's hard to escape, I think it's fair to say. So when I come back, I work for the Northern Trust as a social worker in that area. I live in South Belfast now, close to Queens, where I work.
So before we get into it, I'm just interested in you telling me a bit more about the city, because people coming to Big Spud in June may not have been to Belfast. They may have all sorts of preconceived ideas about what it's like as a city. What is it like?
I'd say the city's pretty buzzing at this stage. I think it's very easy to get into the conversation about Belfast and the troubles and the history, which is very interesting and very important for the city. But like the last 10, 15, 20 years really come on leaps and bounds. And I suppose like the particular area of the city down in the Cathedral Quarter is just filled with restaurants. And so big sell on go to the Cathedral Quarter if you're coming to the conference, definitely. Book a few restaurants and see a few places.
So let's get into the difficult stuff. We're talking about mental capacity and compulsory intervention and personality disorder. Stephanie, and I guess I'd like you to sort of answer this question first and maybe give us an example from your own clinical work. When is it appropriate to force somebody with a diagnosis of personality disorder to go to hospital against their will?
I suppose for myself, in the course of my work, so I'm a service manager in a Belfast Trust, and my responsibilities are all things Mental Capacity Act and approved social work. So at the minute, in terms of the Mental Capacity Act, it's in partial implementation with deprivation of liberty safeguards. But in terms of compulsory admission to hospital, really for mental health support, that would really fall more under the mental health order at the minute in Northern Ireland, because we're running with the two pieces of legislation, which is super duper confusing. So as an approved social worker myself, I do this work, and I still do this work as the manager. And I would have some very recent examples of where perhaps a person who does have a diagnosis of a personality disorder has maybe been picked up by police at a site where they've tried to cause harm to themselves, end their lives by suicide, and be brought to maybe one of our emergency departments. And at that point in time, then there'll be a request for an assessment under the mental health order, and the circumstances whereby the person might be admitted to mental health hospital against their will is if they meet that criteria under the mental health order for admission. Now, important to say that under our mental health order, which is the same age as me, and we're all very glad that it's being replaced with the Mental Capacity Act, there is an exclusion of people being admitted to hospital compulsory who have personality disorder. However, people with personality disorders also get unwell. So generally the person might have suicidal ideation, low mood, depression. So there'll be other things besides personality disorder that's leading the person to a place where they want to cause that significant harm to themselves. So what are criteria is that the person has a mental health condition and that there's a substantial likelihood of serious physical harm to themselves or others. So that would be the specific circumstance whereby the person would be admitted to mental health hospital against their will. It would be if those criteria are met. So it's really a situation whereby ordinarily the risk of serious harm to other people isn't really a feature for these patients. It's the risk of serious physical harm to themselves. And it would be under those circumstances there then that there would be an admission to a psychiatric hospital for support until such a time that that criteria is no longer met.
Steph, it's probably fair to say that we do our best not to use the mental health order and detain people who have personality disorder within their diagnosis. And it's really when the crisis and risk gets into a territory where it's worth assessing for other mental health conditions, that's really the territory we have to be thinking that we're in order to use the mental health order at this stage.
Yeah, you're always looking for the least restrictive option. And if there's a lesser restrictive option to be able to provide the care and support that a person needs at that time of crisis, then that's what we're going to go for. And our mental health order would actually tell us to try to seek out lesser restrictive options, same as our Mental Capacity Act tells us to for DOLs and will tell us to for psychiatric admissions to hospital as well. So it really is, there's no other way to keep this person safe at this time other than a compulsory admission to hospital. But as Ian said, we would be trying lots of other forms of less restrictive interventions before reaching that stage. And ideally, it would be to deal with the crisis as opposed to staying there long term. So you're dealing with a crisis with a view to trying to get a person those longer term supports where they can live as independently as possible.
Gavin, we know that compulsory treatment broadly is often used in a discriminatory way. What does the evidence show about the use of compulsory treatment specifically in people with a diagnosis of personality disorder?
It's a good and difficult question. I think there's an initial issue which Steph and Ian have talked about to address, which is the suggestion that our traditional approach to compulsory intervention for people who are experiencing some form of mental health problems is arguably discriminatory in itself because it doesn't apply to everyone. And the usual approach is to set up a separate sort of capacity-based framework for other issues. So part of the approach which we're trying to develop in Northern Ireland is to have one framework for everyone. So there would be no specific exclusions. It would be capacity-based. So that's one aspect of potential discrimination. And that's sort of if we exclude some people from legal framework and its protections, as well as the possibility of compulsory admission, the whole framework might be set up as discriminatory. In terms of what's the evidence generally for compulsory intervention, and specifically for people with a diagnosis of personality disorder, that's much more difficult to say. I think it's fair to say that there is some evidence, but it's mixed and contested, I think is maybe the best way to frame it. So there's general evidence which looks at use of compulsory admission for people with mental health problems in general, and some evidence that that's helpful and necessary for some people, and also some evidence that people find that unhelpful and indeed potentially sort of negative and further traumatizing. And it's also the consideration that it's difficult in terms of effectiveness. This is a difficult thing to research. There are some randomized controlled trials, which, as you know, I suppose gives us the sort of best idea of if it's specifically the sort of compulsion element, which might be the sort of helpful or unhelpful part. But again, those trials are also contested. So the evidence, unfortunately, doesn't give us a really clear idea of this is really useful for some people in some circumstances or not. It's very mixed. The more helpful evidence that is available is for a whole range of ways of trying to reduce the need for coercion and compulsory admission itself. So that's much more helpful. In terms of the debates around compulsory intervention and specifically for people that diagnose a personality disorder, we need to also stay with, to some extent, the ethical and rights-based arguments.
I wonder if I can ask a follow-up question to that. And I'm thinking about it from the perspective of mental health professionals and criminal justice professionals who are involved in the kind of compulsory treatment decisions. And it's about attitudes to people with a diagnosis of personality disorder. So, you know, if we can broaden out the question that I just asked Gavin there about discrimination around compulsory treatment, just broadly to discrimination towards this group. We know that mental health professionals stigmatize and discriminate against people with personality disorders in a quite a unique way, in that they can't be helped. They're bringing this on themselves. Can you say something about that and how that might weave into this decision-making around compulsory treatment?
Yeah, Andre, I think you're right that the diagnosis of personality disorder is one of the most stigmatized diagnoses within the mental health field. And I suppose it can lead in the direction of black and white sort of arbitrary decisions that should always be made that keep people with personality disorder out of hospital, no matter what, which I think we know isn't always the right answer. But as Gavin's pointing out, there is a real debate in the evidence. And I suppose between the evidence and clinical experience, people do err on the side that long-term admissions for people with personality disorder probably aren't the best thing for most people. And I'm kind of generalizing a bit because each person's an individual in this and the individual circumstances are very important. So I think there can be the discrimination can happen in that if somebody with a personality disorder presents with a serious crisis presentation, some people can take the view they should never be admitted to hospital. Whereas I think there needs to be a lot more clinical nuance thinking about the individual and their circumstances at that point. And, you know, overlapping with some of what Steph was saying as well earlier, if we're talking relatively brief admissions for somebody with personality disorder, whether that's voluntary or detained, that might actually help a lot of people through the worst of moments. But there can be a discrimination happens against doing that at times.
There is a discriminatory element towards people who have a personality disorder. And I really think what that is born out of is a perceived helplessness on the part of the mental health practitioner, where they feel like they are unable to help this person who undoubtedly has quite a traumatic background, and they feel that their intervention doesn't appear to be helping. So I think it comes from that place of frustration. But I really do think the narrative needs to be changed, is that the issue here is not that people are beyond help. The issue and the challenge is that we do not have the right kind of help that people with personality disorders need. And we're sitting in a place between having really, really brilliant treatment and care options that require an ability and to be at a place where you can really engage, and then the alternative being a psychiatric hospital. And the absence of anything in between those two places is what the difficulty is. So it really comes down to our inability to provide appropriate care for somebody, as opposed to there not being any care that could possibly help that person. So I think, I mean, the best that we can do as individuals on this podcast with yourself is to take that stance and challenge the discrimination that we see or hear from people working within the field of mental health. We can really only do it from an individual level, but if enough people do it from an individual level, then that's whenever you can start to really, really see a difference. But we do have under the mental health order that people cannot be detained for the purposes of personality disorder, but people with personality disorders get sick too. And I think that there's this idea that people with personality disorders will only ever have personality disorder, but they can get sick too and have lots of other things, depression, low mood, suicidal ideation, whatever it might be, it is not their be all and end all, that exclusively all that will ever be the matter is personality disorder.
You've recently published a paper, Gavin, that looks at mental health laws across countries. So in your opinion, is there anywhere in the world that's doing this kind of stuff, this mental capacity, compulsory treatment, really well?
Really, everywhere is trying to work out. It's useful to look at sort of developments in other countries. And it's part of the reason why the conference is helpful, getting people together to try and discuss different perspectives on these issues. But there are a few sort of really old examples of approaches which are capacity-based, which are helpful, I think. So, for example, in Ontario, they have a healthcare consent act from 1996, which is just a broad capacity-based framework specifically for treatment decisions, but it's inclusive, it's for everyone. And also in Canada, Saskatchewan, I'm not sure for what reason, but their Mental Health Services Act, which is from, I think, from might be mid-80s, had a capacity-based criterion within their criteria for compulsory admissions since then. So there are some helpful sort of older examples of capacity-based frameworks which have been working for a long time. More recently, there are some interesting debates, for example, I mean, across a number of different jurisdictions, there have been a sort of a reform process looking at the relevant legal frameworks. So, for example, in Australia, in Victoria, they have a Mental Health and Wellbeing Act from 2022, which is much more positively framed in terms of principles and access to services, although in some ways it's still quite a traditional framework. And in New Zealand, they're currently developing a new framework which will have a capacity component to it. I mean, the debates within the Republic of Ireland and within England, Wales and Scotland over recent years are also helpful. I think there's particularly sort of interesting development in Scotland where they're trying to generally, I think, introduce like much greater focus on positive rights, those sort of economic, social and cultural rights, which haven't traditionally been part of mental health and mental capacity law. And I mean, I don't want to overstate this, but I think the approach we're trying to develop in Northern Ireland, which is based on the international literature and in terms of the fusion approach, George Schmuckler is one of the sort of key people who's developed this way of thinking and informed developments here as part of a sort of international debate. So I think the approach that we are trying to implement here, which we've sort of moved towards to some extent, but not fully implemented, it is progressive, I think.
So let's talk a bit more about that. Steph's already told us a bit about the kind of current situation in Northern Ireland, where you've got these sort of two bits of legislation kind of concurrently existing. Ian, do you want to tell us a bit more about the Mental Capacity Act, this kind of non-discriminatory legal framework? What can other countries learn from this, do you think?
Coming from a psychiatry perspective, it's been a big driver in the Royal College of Psychiatrists about the idea of parity of esteem. And I think in the overall health context, it really helps do that. Do you know that people will need to think about this legislation in terms of physical health procedures, and the same legislation applies to mental health disorders as well. So actually taking the discrimination out of that bit, I think that's really, really important. And that integration is something that's very progressive in Northern Ireland compared to everywhere else. So I think that's, for me, that's the pivotal thing that other places could take out of what we're trying to do.
Can you talk us through a little bit how it works in a kind of scenario of somebody with a diagnosis of personality disorders, kind of the complexity there of assessing whether somebody has mental capacity? Yeah.
I think probably the area that this is going to come up the most in is where somebody is in a suicidal crisis and has a personality disorder. And the questions that are going to arise in that situation are, in a state of absolutely heightened distress, do you retain the capacity that you maybe had a couple of days previously? And it is going to come down to very important things like capacity is specific to the decision at that point in time. So it's very difficult for somebody to have said 2 weeks ago, you have capacity, and that to be applied in that crisis situation. I think when somebody's in the most heightened state of distress that they've been in their life, potentially, there is a possibility that people with personality disorder won't have capacity in that moment. And then that's where I think it's going to get really challenging, the ethical dilemmas that you have to think about at that point. So if you decide that somebody doesn't have capacity in that situation, they're actively suicidal, I suppose the first question is, will they consider a voluntary admission? And then you don't have to get into actually detentions and situations like that. And then the other big question is for that individual thing that is going to be in their best interests to go into hospital? And again, these are going to be situation specific. You know, we can't just have a blanket rule of if somebody with personality disorder doesn't have capacity and has an intensification of chronic suicidal thoughts that they must always go into hospital, because it might not be the right thing. And there, as Steph said earlier, there might be other supports we can put around that person. You know, often seeing a clinician who they know very well the next day or as soon as possible can really help contain something of the crisis. So I think these are some of the dilemmas that we're going to get into, that I suppose is part of the reason we wanted to get this on the agenda at Big Spud, because, you know, there is experience in England and across the UK about this, and we really want to hear people's opinions about this, because there's nothing written in stone about what absolutely must happen in every situation, and we've got to take on the nuances and the experiences people have had with capacity legislation in the UK already as well.
So, as you say, it's so dependent on what's happening locally, what the options are for that person. I'm thinking, Steph, you know, where the bed is that we might admit them to, what sort of environment that is like for somebody with a personality disorder diagnosis.
I think even, I mean, you know, we have the Mental Capacity Act here, and it's about capacity, and it's about capacity for all instances. And even through partial implementation at the minute, we're looking at deprivation of liberty safeguards. So where somebody's likely to be deprived of their liberty, regardless of where that is, that's where we're looking at deprivation of liberty safeguards. So a big group of patients who've been impacted by DOLs maybe aren't the people that immediately come to mind. And it would be people in acute medical hospitals who lack capacity as a result, perhaps, of a physical health condition, an infection, something like that. And that would include people who perhaps have a personality disorder. And for those people where previously we might have been keeping them in a medical hospital, even though they perhaps wanted to leave, now what we would be doing is deprivation of liberty safeguards for that person being on a medical ward, even though they want to leave. So we have had instances where perhaps somebody with a personality disorder has maybe taken an overdose, and there's been concerns that they need to go to a medical hospital to have their physical health checked, but they've refused to go. But at that time, we've had a reasonable belief that that person doesn't have capacity to make that decision to go to a medical hospital, and therefore they have to go to a medical hospital as per the Mental Capacity Act, because that's what's in their best interest. They're currently unwell. We don't know to what degree, and we cannot until they've had some examination in hospital. So you can already see that kind of interface in relation to DOLs. So whenever we move to full implementation of the Mental Capacity Act, decisions about people's care and treatment, what support they need, come down to whether or not they have capacity to make that decision. The diagnosis is much less important. And as Ian had kind of said, I would be very hard pushed to be convinced that anybody who's in a heightened state of crisis has capacity to make a decision about a thing at that time. I know myself, if I'm in a heightened state of crisis, I do not have capacity to make a decision at that time. So I think that there's going to be a lot of difficulties and challenges to work through, and a lot of dilemmas, as Ian has said, in relation to actually assessing capacity for people who are complex. At the minute, we are doing a lot of capacity assessments, perhaps for people who have a dementia and things like that. And maybe arguably that can be more straightforward than somebody more able and willing to engage. And I think that that's where a lot of the really big challenges would come. But overall, in terms of being an inclusive legal framework, I would say the mental capacity really, really is. And it is about that focus on, does this person have capacity to make that decision at this time? And if not, what would be in their best interest? And a really big part of that best interest decision is this the least restrictive option for that person? And then another really big part of that best interest decision is having special regard for what that person would have wanted had they been able to make that decision themselves. So this completely changes the narrative about how we provide care for people who need it whenever they can't decide what care they need themselves.
I'm interested in your thoughts about what legislation can do to support mental health professionals to not discriminate against people with personality disorders when they're making these kinds of assessments.
With the Mental Capacity Act here, we are trying to establish a legal framework which in itself isn't discriminatory. However, it doesn't resolve the really complex issues of assessment and intervention. So I think we can agree that people with a diagnosis of personality disorder, there may be issues they're experiencing which are associated with that, which do impair their ability to make specific decisions at a specific time. And if that's the case, it's reasonable that they do come under the scope of a capacity-based framework, just as anybody whose ability to make a decision being impaired should, because the framework should provide a process and safeguards for decisions being made. The framework, though, doesn't resolve how you assess all the complex issues needed to make that decision about whether a person lacks capacity for the decision at that time. And then, as we've already talked about, even if you do conclude that they are, despite all available support, they are unable to make that decision, the legal framework, it gives you a process to then to try and work out what might be in the person's subjective best interest. But we don't know definitively, as we were talking about in terms of the research evidence, how helpful the use of compulsory intervention is for everyone in all the sort of complexities of life and situations people are in. The sort of greatest potential for positive developments are in thinking about how we support people to make their own decisions, and also what alternatives we can provide to prevent, ideally, the need for any sort of compulsory intervention. And also, in circumstances where it is necessary to use compulsory intervention, how can we make that most helpful and least traumatizing it can be? Yeah.
I guess we're coming back full circle, aren't we, Steph, to the point you made before about the fact that professionals are really frustrated because they don't have the means to support these people off. We don't have the services available to give people what they need. What do you think? There's only so much that legal frameworks can do. What do you think we need to do in services to really provide what's needed for people with a diagnosis of personality disorder that are going through these moments of crisis?
I think it really comes down to trying to learn from what other places are doing and what other places have done well. It's not for a lack of desire to be able to provide a service, to be able to support people who are in the situations of maybe having those frequent short-term admissions to hospital and discharging again. And we do all acknowledge that perhaps a psychiatric hospital, it could contribute to a sort of learned helplessness, because you're going into a hospital where everything's done for you. It's not good for skills development for anybody. But I think that we need to learn, and perhaps there's a place for some more research to see what would work well. I think that for the first time in a long time, there's a lot of attention paid to this particular group of people who do have personality disorders, and thinking, what can we do to better support people? Because as I said, there are some brilliant sort of treatments, the likes of what Ian Dunn does in his team with the mentalization-based treatment out there, that people find really, really helpful, but they need to be at a place where they're ready to engage. And for those people who are in crisis and frequent crisis, perhaps every other week, even as consistent as that, we need to start trying to think of, is there some other better way? Is there something that we need to have where we can be able to support people in that instance, where you're not looking at necessarily a compulsory admission to hospital? They're not ready to engage in a community-based treatment, but is there something else that we can do? So I really think that it is the time to start really seriously looking at that, with the acknowledgement that we all know that for really the majority of people, a psychiatric hospital, it is not the right place, but a supportive environment where you feel safe, that is necessary during those times of crisis. What that looks like, I don't know. And I'd be really, really interested to hear other people's views on that. And certainly for going to Big Spid in Belfast, that would be something that I'd be really, really interested in hearing from people there.
Yeah, you will certainly hear a lot of that from this conference, I'm sure. Ian, I'm interested in your thoughts as we're drawing to a close on the sort of mindset change that we've seen in the last 10 years or so. We're thinking a lot more about trauma and abuse and its relationship to mental illness now than we did previously. Services are talking about being trauma-informed. As a jobbing psychiatrist for the last decade, what's your sort of reflection on all of that?
I think my starting point from somebody working in a specialist personality disorder service, I think most, if not all, personality disorder services are integrally trauma-informed. I think the evidence-based treatments for personality disorder, whether it's MBT, DBT, TFP, CAT, they all come from a, I need to understand you as a person, what's happened to you. So I feel quite confident that that approach is trauma-informed. I think the area where it probably gets into a real dilemma is about diagnosis and the complexity of what gets considered as borderline personality disorder and what gets considered as complex PTSD. And I kind of feel that we're on a journey with that, and it's got to marry together somewhere over the next 10 years how those diagnoses really overlap an awful lot, and as professionals, how we think of it. I suppose if somebody's diagnosed with borderline personality disorder and it goes well, the individual will often say, like, life's been chaos for me for years. All this has been going on. I have a framework that I know that I'm not going completely crazy, because there is this label called borderline personality disorder that I can now understand all that from. The other side to that is if somebody really does not like that language and has a preference for the language of trauma and complex PTSD, I think you have to keep it patient-centered, and there is no point in fighting with the patient about which of those two diagnoses it should be, because they're so close and so intertwined. And I know there's a counter argument about retaining the diagnosis of personality disorder as well, but I think we're on a journey as mental health professionals of how we marry those two things together better.
But Gavin, last word to you. You're going to have 500 people or so in a room in Belfast listening to the three of you in a couple of months' time. Some of them might be tempted to, have a bit more time in bed or spend a bit more time at the coffee store because, this is the talk all about legislation.
Yeah.
Why should people come along to this? Why is it important that people hear this stuff?
Yeah. I think it does address really sort of fundamental issues about as a society, how we should try and support each other and also sort of promote and protect our rights. So I think it is a lens by which we can discuss some of those more difficult issues. I mean, we'll also be hopefully given a reasonably accessible and interesting account of what we're trying to do in Northern Ireland and some of the context of here for people who might not be so familiar with Belfast. And we'll try and engage with those issues about not only about sort of the legal framework, but the implications of that for all of the other things we could be doing in terms of moving more towards sort of trauma-informed care and those range of interventions that do have a good evidence base in terms of reducing the need for compulsory intervention. We're also keen to engage with the discussion. My understanding is that in general, this conference, the sort of the involvement of people who are using services is central to it. And I suppose more generally in the development of the legal framework here and in the development of services with a sort of relatively recent sort of mental health strategy, that does seem to be one of the main ways that we can try to ensure that both the legal framework and services are developing in ways which are helpful to people.
Big thanks to Gavin, Ian and Steph for sharing their time and knowledge so generously. I'm really looking forward to covering their session at the conference and seeing the response to their talk from other Big Spud members and delegates. Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you found it interesting and thought-provoking. We've got more podcasts coming up with Mel Ball, Sonia Johnson, Anthony Bateman and others. And if you haven't got your conference tickets yet, don't delay. They're selling like pints of the black stuff on a Friday night in the Belfast Cathedral Quarter. You can book now at bigspud.org.uk And there are currently some discounts on registration fees if you're booking a group of five or more people. So get your whole team along and join us in June. I'm Andre from The Mental Elf, signing off. See you again soon.